You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Most people are anything but nostalgic when they think back to their grade school math classes, but Jordan Ellenberg says that all those kids who asked the teacher why it was necessary to learn how to multiply fractions or find the square root of 147 were missing the point. Learning math is not just about numbers, he says. It's common sense extended by other means. And if you pay attention, you'll note that math is always present as we move through our daily lives. In his new book, How Not to Be Wrong, The Power of Mathematical Thinking, Professor Ellenberg, who teaches mathematics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, reveals how math plays a role in public opinion polling, buying a lottery ticket, and figuring out the total impact of the war in Iraq. It's published by Penguin Press. I'm very pleased it has brought Jordan Ellenberg to our show. Hi.
Hi, great to be on.
You include a lot of history in this book, from the political to the literary to the athletic. Are we missing a big part of the story if we just focus on the numbers when we think about math?
I think so, and that was part of what was so exciting about writing the book for me. You know, when we learn math, when you learn math in a high school course, or even when you learn math at the PhD level like I did, you don't learn a lot about the history. You learn the techniques, you learn the rules, you learn the facts. But I think to really understand an idea, it helps to try to put yourself in the place of what it was like to not know this idea, what it was like to not understand it, and what it's like to be present at the moment of its creation.
Is math necessary to understanding and appreciating history?
I think some parts of history. I think it's one of the strands.
Well, I remember when they taught us about Egypt and the Nile and how they, after the Nile flooded, a form of geometry was developed simply so people could know what their land, where their land was.
Right. And it's been a part of, I mean, math has been a part of every human society we've ever had, right? Like imagining a society that functioned without math is like imagining a society like without music or without sex, right? It's like a fundamental part of the human condition. And I think when you look back in history, you see that people didn't used to see mathematics as a separate sphere of thought from the other things they were thinking about, philosophy, religion, economics, warfare. It was all mixed together.
Especially philosophy. A number of philosophers were either mathematicians like Pascal or used math like Spinoza to work out their philosophical ideas.
Right. And that's actually very inspiring, not just for people who are not involved in math, but for people like me who do math every day and maybe in a way that often in our research is not so tied in with philosophical questions or real-world questions.
You don't shy away from humor here. Can math be funny? It isn't. The class clown in my high school was not one of the good math students.
I mean, I think maybe I'll say something slightly provocative. I think really good math is almost always funny.
How?
Well, in the sense that where does humor come from? It comes from this moment of surprise, this moment of recognition, this moment of connection between two things that seem disparate. That's what you do when you do mathematics, too. And I think when you really study the subject, this moment of kind of shocked joy when you come across a really beautiful argument is not so unlike the appreciation of, like, a truly witty remark or a truly funny gag.
Oh, I thought that you had to kind of apply the rules of a quadratic equation to developing a joke. I've always thought of math as a process of hoping to solve a problem and then coming to a happy conclusion. But you describe the language of math as sometimes being violent, although also sometimes being pastoral. Can you give us an example?
It's true. Well, in math, we often talk about killing things or even annihilating things. Or decomposing things is another thing we often do in technical mathematical terminology. So that's the violent side. But also in math, we often talk about fields and sheaves and stalks and rings and like nice things like that. So, I mean, each field kind of has its own verbal flavor. I think sometimes something that people don't know about math is that it's made of words. People think it's numbers, long strings of digits and equal signs and the occasional operation. But math is made of words, math is made of arguments, math is made of sentences.
A few mathematical phrases have invaded the public lexicon, like exponential growth, lowest common denominator. Does that distort their meanings?
I think we have to accept that as a math word or any technical word comes out into the common lexicon, it's going to broaden and adopt new colors that it doesn't have for us. I mean, I think we should be comfortable with the same thing that the psychoanalysts are. You know, we all talk about like acting out or people being anal or regressing. Those used to be very technical
passive
terms.
Aggressive.
Passive aggressive, that's right. But I think those words, I think the psychoanalysts are happy because they recognize that word had some force. That's why it got taken on. So for us, I think words like lowest common denominator, words like orthogonal, meaning unrelated, which I read about in the book, I think that's on the cusp. That will be the next hot math word. Here's my prediction, orthogonal.
Didn't you once review scripts for the TV show Numbers?
I did. What an experience. They would send them to me. It's on a very fast scale. They would send the script, and a bunch of mathematicians would check to see if there was any really grievous mathematical errors. And the feedback loop is so fast. You know, you send it back by email, and then 3 days later, you see these famous movie stars saying these things on TV.
Did that experience tell you anything about the public perception of math?
I think what I learned from it is that, you know, at first, of course, your first reaction is like, oh, let's see how much math we can teach in the context of this show. But that's not really what the show is about. The show is a cop show. The show is about police officers like running around like shooting guns. That's what cop shows are about. And I became quite comfortable with that. I think we have to, as educators, we want to broadcast on every kind of channel, from Danica McKellar's books that are aimed at middle school girls to cop shows that are aimed at people who like cop shows. Different people engage with different kinds of media, so.
You mentioned that math uses language. Language tends to be linear. Can math explain language?
There are certainly a lot of people who think about stuff like that. There's a very interesting guy called Martin Novak at Harvard who tries to model the evolution of language from disorganized grunting by a complicated series of differential equations. I've seen him give very beautiful talks about that.
The language of math can be intimidating in itself. For example, the phrase residually modular Galois representations.
Yeah, which is something that I work on. Galois representations.
It's Galois?
Galois, yeah.
Galois.
Like, a lot of our forebears
are like
French.
It's like a cigarette.
So. Yes. but better for you.
Now, I looked it up. I Googled it, and I could not understand what it was all about.
Well, you know, that's one thing. Somebody like me is going to operate on two streams, right? Because when I'm home being a professor and working on my research, you know, this book is not about that, right? There's some things that I do that are internal to the profession. But there's so much of math that it doesn't require you to get a PhD to understand, and that was what I wanted to write a book about.
There's also the math can be understood by people who speak different languages. They don't even have to speak the same language. But they're speaking the language of math, aren't they?
That's right. It is kind of a universal. I mean, when I was in high school, I used to have a shirt that said, "Math brings friends together." It was in English and Ukrainian. And I did not wear this shirt ironically. Like, I really felt it. And I think that is a true fact, that it's sort of a cultural universal.
My guest is Jordan Ellenberg. His book, How Not to Be Wrong, The Power of Mathematical Thinking. Politicians and salespeople alike use statistics to persuade people. It's often been pointed out, statistics can be misleading. How can something that's accurate still be misleading?
Oh, it's much more common than you think. I write in the book about percentages of negative numbers. I actually just excerpted this piece on Slate, if people want to read it, in a piece called How to Lie with Negative Numbers. There is famous cases where a governor may say, oh, my state created half the jobs that were created in the whole United States over the past month. Well, that sounds pretty great until you realize that, oh, there were plenty of other states that created even more jobs than his state. It's not that he created as many jobs as everybody else. It's that some states gained and some states lost. So that's a good example of something that he said that it's literally true, right? You can't say that he told a lie per se, but you can say facts that are true but which are intended to mislead. And I think one role the mathematicians have is exactly to call out things like that.
How has proportional thinking been applied to talking about the war in Iraq?
All right, so this is a part of the book where I talk about a common rhetorical move that people make. They'll say something that happens in a small country like Israel or Palestine and say, like, well, these five people who are killed in the attack are the equivalent of 600 people killed in the United States. I don't have the numbers right to my hand, so I'm making them up. And I kind of try to push back on that by showing the sort of absurdities that you can get into if you take those kinds of metaphors literally. And fundamentally, by the way, I think this is a good example of where you see mathematical questions getting mixed up with a philosophical question and a moral question. Because if you say these five people getting killed are equivalent to these other 600 people getting killed, you are saying something that's kind of morally weird. And you have to sort of not just let the math do the talking for you, but actually think about what you're saying.
What's the benefit of nonlinear thinking, and how can it help you avoid things like con men?
Well, linear thinking, which in many ways is right and it's very powerful, can be misleading when you're dealing with nonlinear phenomena. So the way so one example that I talk about in the book is the famous Laffer curve, which if you remember, mm-hmm. a guy called Ronald Reagan, who used to be president, it was a keystone of the economics of that time. And it was based on the idea, which is really correct, that there's not a direct linear relationship between how much you tax the population and how much tax the government gets. If it were a straight line, now I'm making a hand gesture that no one can see, it would either go up, more taxes, more revenue, or it would go down, more taxes, less revenue. But in fact, it's more like a curve. It goes up and then down, which is something a line simply cannot do. So if you're wedded to some theoretical construct that it's a line, if raising taxes is good, raising taxes more must be better, in some ranges, you're going to make a mistake.
But Laffer's curve has also been made kind of disreputable over the years. Was there something wrong with its thinking as well?
Well, what I give in the book is actually, I would say, a kind of like muted defense of Laffer's curve, because I think Laffer's curve itself is not wrong. What's wrong is his view about where we were on the curve.
You also write about a Baltimore stockbroker. How is he important to our understanding of probability?
So this is kind of a parable, and I actually did a lot of research to find out if this ever actually happened, and I was unable. But the story is that you get a stock tip from a guy in the mail, a guy you don't know, a guy from Baltimore, and the stock tip turns out to be right. The stock he says is going to go up goes up. And the next week you get another one, and it's again right. And the next week you get another one, and it's again right. And you start to think, oh my God, this guy is amazing. This guy's really figured out something, really figured out how to predict the market. And, you know, after a few of these, you invest all your money in this guy's company. But what you don't know is that this guy starts by sending thousands and thousands of those newsletters out, half saying this stock is going to go up, half saying it's going to go down. And the people who he misled, he doesn't send to them anymore. He's done with them. So this kind of metaphor, it turns out that there's a lot of the issues that we're having today with reproducibility of scientific experiments, in some sense, are mathematically the same as the problem of the Baltimore stockbroker. And that's one thing that I think math is really good at, taking things that look different on the surface and being like, the understructure of this problem is the same, even though they're about different things and exist in different contexts.
But you do tell a story of how MIT students use math to bring about the downfall of the Massachusetts cash windfall lottery.
Yeah, it's an amazing story that Massachusetts was redesigning their lottery because people weren't playing. People weren't winning the jackpot enough. People were depressed and discouraged. And they were like, let's change the rules to make this look like a better deal for the player. And unfortunately, they did too good of a job and made it actually be a better deal for the player. And these kids from MIT and a bunch of other groups besides figured this out, and over the course of about 7 years took about $3.5 million from the Massachusetts lottery.
You can't do that with Powerball?
You can't do it with Powerball. Powerball has the rules it has, and they're pretty satisfied with them, and you can't do it. I looked to see if there was any other lotteries going on now with these rules, but there are not.
People accept irrationality when they play Powerball and other lotteries.
They do. That's right, but I'm not so sure it is so irrational. It's irrational from a strictly financial point of view, but I would say, I mean, there's a lot of competing theories about this, but I think that the simplest one is probably mostly right, which is that when you buy a $2 Powerball ticket, you're buying about $2 worth of fun, and the small chance of winning is gravy on top of that.
You say that public opinion doesn't exist. Isn't there a whole industry that's devoted to it?
Well, I state it maybe more provocatively than I should. Public opinion sometimes exists about some subjects, but in other areas it can be quite complicated. And the example I talk about in the book is the fact that Americans will always tell you they want smaller government and that the government should spend less. And they will also tell you, if you run down a list of actual programs that the federal government spends money on, each one down the line, okay, should we cut funding here or increase? People will say, well, that's important. We should increase it. Defense, we should increase. Medicaid, we should increase. Like funding for K-12 schools, we should increase. And a lot of times I think social scientists act quite mystified by this. But what I explain in the book is that actually people can be completely rational and still you see these effects where there's apparent paradoxes when you study the majority will.
We have, there's a lot of stuff in this book that I wanted to talk about. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. But you also tried your hand at writing fiction once. You wrote a novel, The Grasshopper King.
I did. I wrote it.
Was that kind of a release from thinking about math?
That was something I did. I went away from math for a while and went to Johns Hopkins and studied creative writing with John Barth and Robert Stone, and I wrote that book. And it was in many ways a great experience, but every day I missed math. Every day I was like, man, I'm not doing math, and it stinks not to be doing math.
Jordan Ellenberg is a professor of mathematics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He also writes a popular column called Do the Math for Slate. His book, How Not to Be Wrong, The Power of Mathematical Thinking, is published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.